Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
It's Aaron Rupar Day on the podcast, but first I've got breaking news. You don't have to listen to all these commercials, including what I'm saying right now. How the hell does that work? Well, just go to patreon.com/Bob Seska Show and sign up for the ultimate edition of the podcast. If you do, you're going to get an entirely commercial-free version of the show presented exclusively on the Patreon page and the Patreon app. Plus, you're going to get the Shadow Docket bonus shows, the Friday After Party, and so much more. Again, that's the ultimate edition at patreon.com/Bob Seska Show. And now let the cartoons begin.
The Bob Seska Show.
Bob Seska.
Hi, Bob.
Hi, Bob.
Hi, Bob.
The Bob Seska Show.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, April 24, 2024, and this is the Bob Seska Interview on the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. Hi, I'm Bob.
Hello, Bob.
Hi, day 1,191 of the Biden-Harris administration, 195 days into the 24 presidential election. You can find me on Threads and Instagram at TheBobSeska, Twitter, BobSeska_go, and our Patreon page is BobSeskaShow.com. One of the best things about staying on Twitter, despite all of its horrendousness, is, of course, Aaron Rupar's feed. In addition to keeping us laughing at Trump's constant short circuits and glitches, Aaron is also reminding voters what exactly it was like 4 years ago under Donald Trump. So today, Aaron returns to the interview show to talk about the state of the campaign and the state of political social media. And don't forget his Substack newsletter, publicnotice.co, link in the description. Meantime, don't forget to support this podcast by subscribing to us at patreon.com/Bob Seska Show. Okay, here's me catching up with the great Aaron Rupar.
More fun, more music, the Bob Seska Show.
So, you know, this is the first time we've talked after your no fucks left announcement. Talk about what motivated your decision to not candy coat your opinions of Trump anymore. I didn't think you were doing that before, but now you've completely unleashed yourself, right?
I think that was more of a message kind of to people on the left where, you know, I was feeling like I was seeing a lot of false equivalencies and kind of both siding the whole Trump situation and the whole election this year. And so, you know, it wasn't really meant to. I think I've always kind of been pretty direct when it comes to Trump, but, you know, I'm just trying to encourage people who I view as kind of fellow travelers on the left or at least center left to try and convey the stakes of what we're up against this year as concisely and clearly as possible.
It's incredible that we still have to do that. It's mind-boggling that in addition to just talking about the stakes of what could happen in a second Trump term, we also have to rewind and go back to what happened 4 years ago. Seems like there's this either national amnesia or delusion about the first Trump term. Have you been noticing anything along those lines, or am I just being paranoid about where voters are at this point?
I think it's pretty easy to memory hole a lot of the stuff that we lived through with Trump. And, you know, I had a big piece in the newsletter last Friday that the whole premise was that Trump's COVID response was even worse than you remember.
Yeah.
And I'm sure for me and you, you know, we probably remember most of the ins and outs of that. And, you know, it was a time in my life where, you know, my wife was very pregnant at the time. And obviously we weren't going anywhere because everybody was quarantined. So I had a lot of time to clip. And I was watching each and every one of those Trump news conferences every night. And, you know, I've been reliving them because I've been doing on Twitter, you know, kind of like a 4 year ago today, a little thing I've been doing on Twitter every day. And so I've been revisiting these COVID press briefings, and it just reminded me of all of the deflection, the blaming of Obama for not developing tests for a virus that didn't exist when he was in office, and, you know, the constant squabbling with governors and reporters. And I think that, you know, because it was such a weird time, 2020, it's kind of easy to, you know, to memory hole it or to just kind of overlook how strange it was. And a lot of that was, you know, a result of Trump's mishandling of the pandemic. And so the premise of the piece in the newsletter was basically that, you know, that in and of itself should disqualify him from serving again. And, you know, I think really that is the biggest disaster of his presidency. You know, other than that, you know, I think there's a lot of amnesia, or there's a lot of, I guess, longing is the better term for 2019 on the right. You know, the sense that the economy was, you know, the greatest economy in world history in 2019, when, you know, I think in actuality, there was a lot of coasting happening from the Obama years at that time. So, yeah, I mean, it is weird. I do sense that, you know, it's the old Ronald Reagan question, I guess, right? Are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? And it seems like Republicans kind of want to change that into 5 years ago for kind of obvious reasons. And so I think it's important we don't let them do that.
Except that it's super cynical for them to say 4 years ago, because they're assuming that people don't remember. And that's what I continue to find astonishing. And I think part of the problem, Aaron, is I'm sure something that you've observed too, is that the traditional press, the traditional cable news and so forth, has a really hard time covering all of the Trump things, which appears to be part of his strategy. If he floods the zone enough, then the press can't possibly cover all the things. So, you know, you're talking about maybe he gets away with 75% of it because the press can only cover 25% of what he's done and what he plans to do. How can that change? Is there any way to right the course as far as the press's ability to be able to cover this guy?
It's really difficult in that you're right. There's just so many different scandals and criminality. You know, it's such a target-rich environment. It's hard to know what to prioritize. And I think it's going to vary, obviously, depending on what your objectives are. I mean, I think, you know, there's one question to be had around kind of political messaging and activism, and then another one, I think, around journalism and what's responsible reporting and, you know, what's kind of conveying stakes to readers and viewers in a way that informs them instead of confuses them. And so, but I think this was kind of one of the things that we've seen all along with Trump, right, is that there's so many different scandals that you could be talking about that it does end up, you know, there's kind of like a principle where they cancel each other out after a while, or, you know, people so quickly move on to the next thing that the import of the previous one doesn't really fully sink in. And so I don't know. I mean, it's a really difficult question. I mean, I can only kind of speak to my own, you know, experiences running the newsletter. And, you know, we've been really focused, obviously, on the Trump trials, just because it's such an unprecedented situation and trying to explain what's going on with those. And I think that's going to dominate the news cycle this year and kind of dominate the campaign cycle, because we're already seeing that, you know, Trump doesn't really have the wherewithal to both campaign and be in courtrooms 4 days a week for these trials. And so, you know, I think they're going to be kind of intertwined all year, both the cases and the campaign, in a way that's probably going to be damaging for him. But, you know, when we're talking about these trials, we're not really talking about his policy proposals, which are pretty horrific in and of themselves, or kind of half-baked in other instances. And so, yeah, I don't really know. I mean, in terms of what we should be talking about, how to prioritize. But, I guess the thing is that Trump always does at least give you a lot to talk about.
That's for sure. It looks like the empty podium shots that we saw in 2016 and to a certain extent in 2020 are now the empty parking garage shots, where they've got that pen set up for him, that little square of barricades where he goes out during breaks in the trial and stands there. And I noticed that Cable's got the empty playpen shots in the parking garage. What was the point of sticking Trump in that tiny square pen? Any clue as to what that is? Is a security thing that he needs to be just in this little square, or what's that all about?
I would assume it's a security thing. I mean, not being there, it's hard for me to say without kind of having more context because I'm not familiar with those, you know, with those courtrooms specifically. But, I will note that, I think Trump goes out there and he does his little statements as part of this idea that he had, which he talked about publicly, that he was going to try to turn these trials into a campaigning opportunity for himself. But you notice that, they're very low energy. I mean, it's kind of the same rant every day, 2 to 3 minutes about, how Biden is colluding with these prosecutors and, Biden's out campaigning. It's unfair. And the gag orders are unconstitutional. And it's just, it's kind of the same old stuff. And I don't think it's really breaking through in a way that's helping him. But I think, Trump thought that when he printed out his Fox News articles and waved them around that, that was some sort of way to own the libs or something. But I think it just makes him look pretty strange. Mm-hmm. And then we're seeing yesterday he was complaining about how, the thousands of protesters that he alleged were in New York weren't being allowed to assemble around the courthouse when there's absolutely no evidence that there was more than like 2 or 3 people willing to demonstrate on his behalf down there. And so I don't think any of this is really helping him, but I also can't really shake the feeling sometimes that we're, kind of in a way of being now where nothing really matters, And so I guess this election ultimately ends up being kind of a referendum on whether anything matters, because I think when you look at it, in terms of Biden's record vis-a-vis Trump's record, the Reagan question of 4 years ago and whether we're better off. I mean, there's really no case to be made for Trump, other than, I guess, kind of his cult followers love him. And, can the Democratic coalition be fractured just enough to help him win? Mm-hmm. And so, I guess we'll see come November if anything matters or not.
It seems like just a few things on the Biden side of the ledger will absolutely doom Biden. I mean, this is kind of the conventional wisdom that we're seeing right now. A couple of things about Joe Biden, completely screw his campaign, making him lose in November. But yet the gazillion Donald Trump things seem to have no bearing whatsoever on all of this. I think that's the frustrating dichotomy that we're seeing in some of the coverage, too, that I just can't make heads or tails of it. And the consequence of it is, does anything matter anymore? Basis for how people are deciding. And I, I don't know. It feels like so many voters, at least if you believe the polls a little bit, that so many voters just don't know what's going on. Do you get that sense too?
Yeah, I do. It's hard for me to judge that because the people I'm interacting with are obviously very politically engaged. And so they're not kind of your typical voter, but I think you're right that you kind of see a bubble up in the polling a little bit. Or, the one that's burned into my mind was, it was a couple months ago now, but the New York Times did one of their little kind of like focus groups with 12 independent voters, and they quoted their reasons for supporting one or the other candidate. And there was a woman who identified as being a Democrat, but said that she would not vote for Biden this cycle because she blamed Biden for the ending of national reproductive rights. Mm-hmm. And, just like the confusion that you have to have that viewpoint that, somehow you're overlooking the fact that Trump appointed these justices and that, it's really on him. And you're just kind of thinking of it in a temporal way where it's like, well, this happened under Biden's watch, so he's to blame. Mm-hmm. And I do think that's kind of a common instinct that people have, where inflation obviously hurts people. It happened under Biden's watch, even though the causes of it go further back, to the pandemic and supply chains and, trying to stimulate the economy. But a lot of people just kind of react to things that happen and blame the person in charge. And, that's that's at times helped Democrats and at times hurt them. But I think, that's one thing that's going to hurt Biden is the perception of the economy in terms of inflation and how that has hurt people. And, you just kind of do your best to educate people. But, obviously a lot of voters are kind of too far gone and can't be reached in that way. So you just hope that there's enough people making responsible choices where in the end, we still end up having our democracy and having a functional republic beyond this year.
I mean, the amount of time you spend, Aaron, covering Donald Trump, have you reached a point where you can sort of separate yourself from the actual consequences of what you're covering, almost like a doctor who can kind of emotionally withdraw from the peril of their patients? Have you reached that point where you can do that, or is this still grinding away at you? Is this wearing on you emotionally?
I think if it was wearing on me emotionally, I couldn't really be doing this anymore. like you mentioned, this is basically year 8. I started covering Trump in February 2016. Uh-huh. And I started with kind of the full immersion a little bit later that year, watching pretty much all of his speeches and all the events that he was doing. And so, I cover it like a journalist, I think, kind of covers anything, in the sense that you kind of take a step back from it and just try to convey information to people, or, you know, convey what Trump is up to. Obviously, I have my own values and principles, and I think it would be a tragedy if he returned to power. And so I don't try to kind of pretend that, you know, I don't have those beliefs, or that I'm approaching this with kind of some false notion of objectivity. But I think you're also kind of right that, you know, it's very repetitive covering Trump at this point. I mean, you watch his rallies, they have not changed very much. I mean, going all the way back to like 2018, he's still kind of using a lot of the same economic talking points. Mm-hmm. The immigration stuff has barely changed. The migrant crime stuff he's been doing for a long time. The anti-LGBT stuff, the blustering about foreign policy, railing against NATO. I mean, all this stuff has been very consistent over the years. And so I do think watching his rallies in that way is a little bit less interesting than it used to be, just because it's become very predictable. Mm-hmm. But I've also been kind of surprised. You know, he seemed to be kind of ramping it up, during the primary, when there was still kind of a live primary campaign with Nikki Haley still being in the race. And, you know, he was out there doing a lot of rallies, and it kind of felt like, you know, the old Trump mode of campaigning. And maybe we're just kind of in a lull right now, since, you know, we're still like, what, 5 months out. And, the general campaign hasn't really heated up. But, I just saw before we hopped in this call that Biden was on speech number two today, you know, just this morning, that he was on a second speech to different audiences. And he had a really good zinger on Trump, talking about how Trump during COVID suggested people shoot up bleach, but he must have missed and it all went into his hair. And was kind of, you know, and then people were laughing. You know, it was really quite a very un-Biden-like scene, where, you know, it almost kind of reminded me in some ways of like a reaction that you get at a Trump rally, with people laughing and clapping. And, but anyway, my point simply being that, you know, Biden's out there campaigning, and it seems like it's been kind of low energy on Trump's side. We already talked about his little courtroom rants that he does, but, you know, he had a rally last weekend scheduled in North Carolina, which I think was his first in like 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And he ended up having to cancel it because I guess the weather he thought was too dicey either to fly there or for people to stand outside while he was speaking. So, but the other thing, you know, that I think that I've been thinking about that, I think is interesting, is that I think there's a good case to be made that these rallies, when he does have them, are actually hurting Trump a lot more at this point than they're helping, because he's basically just speaking to his hardcore base. I mean, these speeches are really bringing in new voters. But then in addition to that, you know, it's mostly providing grist for accounts like mine, ASIN, or even like the Biden HQ account, which I think has been really effective to kind of flip up stuff that he says and, you know, kind of highlight how bonkers a lot of it is. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just not sure, you know, if kind of the traditional Trump rally mode of campaigning isn't doing him more harm than good, or won't do more harm than good, to the extent he's able to get out there and actually do rallies this summer. So, it does grind me down a little bit, but I think that if it was kind of breaking me as a person, I wouldn't still be doing this.
Please, please, for the love of God, do not break, my friend. Jesus. But in terms of his rallies, I want to talk about his short circuits, because there's been a lot of conversation about how they've become more frequent, but they're more hilarious now. I don't know what it is. How do you peg those things? Is this a matter of his cognitive abilities, or is this just a series of gaffes that he's terrible at actually handling when they happen?
You know, I'd push back on that a little bit, in that I feel like the short circuiting thing has been pretty consistent going back to at least when he was president. Uh-huh. I don't remember him doing that in 2016, but I do remember noticing and clipping them, you know, as early as like 2017, 2018, the infamous speech where his dentures fell out. And I don't know if you remember that.
The Jerusalem speech? Yeah.
No, I can't remember what the topic of the speech was. I just remember that his teeth were falling out and he could barely talk by the end of it.
Right.
That was in late 2017.
Right. It was in the White House. I remember that. Pence was there and he said, "God bless United States," something like that.
That's the exact one. I'm pretty sure that was December 2017. And so my point simply being that I think he's been doing this for, and I get DMs. I got one from someone just over the weekend who, you know, was kind of making this, it was a very long DM that was making a case that Trump has dementia and how people should be talking about this. And to me, it's just kind of been the same. Like, I don't think there's been any noticeable decline. I think if anything, to me, he seemed a little more run down when he was president, for obvious reasons, you know, just with having a little more on his plate than he does these days. Although I guess with the trial, he's got kind of a different sort of stress, perhaps. But I don't think there's been a noticeable decline in that way. But, you know, he did have one that I clipped a couple weeks ago, I think, which is at still his most recent rally, where you could see his brain kind of misfired, and he ended up trying to cover for it. But, you know, it didn't look great. And, you know, I don't know if that's just kind of routine aging, if that's, you know, if there is something cognitively wrong with him. But, you know, I guess what I would say is that I think if Trump was kind of on his last legs or was really falling apart, I think he'd have a harder time than he does doing speeches that last, you know, sometimes up to 90 minutes, 2 hours. And obviously he's all over the place. It's a word salad. They're not like highly cogent, you know, great pieces of oration or anything like that. But I don't get the sense that he's like falling apart or isn't going to make it to the finish line here.
Yeah. And I always thought, I kind of pegged it this way, Aaron, that the reason his short circuits are so hilarious is because he's such an unforgivable bully, because he's such an asshole. When he himself screws up, that makes it extra funny. And you've got to be at a place now where when it happens, you're like, oh boy, this will be a great post. This is really going to go on social media, right? I mean, you got to, on some point, you're licking your chops. Like, I can't wait to post this.
That last one that I posted from his speech, and I'm blanking on where the speech was, but that was one where definitely in the moment I was like, wow, that was really bad. And that's probably going to blow up pretty good on Twitter, which it did.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I try to, you know, when I'm going to post stuff like that, I try to make sure that it is kind of a clean shot, so to speak, in that, you know, everybody, I mean, you listen to Biden and he's stumbling over words all the time. And we, you know, it's been much discussed that he has a speech impediment and, you know, he's been dealing with stuttering throughout his entire political career.
Yeah.
And so you don't want to be kind of, you know, like, you don't want to make too much light of it. And then when Biden does it, kind of let it go. I mean, it's just, you know, it speaks to being kind of unfair or something like that. So, you know, when I do post Trump clips like that, it's the really egregious ones. It's not him kind of like, you know, stumbling over a word, because I think any of us would do that. You know, if we were speaking in public like that. But yeah, I don't think they have gotten worse, but they are very noticeable. And there's something going on there. I'm not a doctor, you know, so I'm not going to try and diagnose them. But
smart.
Yeah, it's you know, they're not kind of routine stumbling over words. It's some sort of brain misfiring going on for sure.
Okay, short break. Back with more Aaron Rupar right after this.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Hi, it's Randy Rhodes, and here's what you missed.
They're reporting that he looks miserable, and shouldn't that be enough?
No! If he looks miserable in court, all dressed up and ready to go, imagine what he'll look like in an orange jumpsuit. Just imagine what he'll look like. I mean, this trial, I want to see it. I can't say that often enough and more aggressively than that. I want to see it. Michael Cohen went to jail for this. David Pecker, oh God, we're really sitting here saying Trump and porn star and Pecker and gag in the same, see Brett, see what it's doing to you?
I didn't see till you just did that.
Well, that's how it's playing in my head. I mean, I want to see the trial. I don't want to hear people talk about porn stars and Pecker and gag and Trump in the same breath. Stop it. Don't have time to listen to the live show? Want to hear more on your schedule? Go to randyrhodes.com and buy a stinking podcast.
Bob Seska. All-time favorites all day long.
I think you should feel proud of the fact that there is that Biden-Harris HQ account, because it seems like that was directly inspired by what you and then secondarily ASIN have been doing for many, many years now. And I think the campaign noticed that, okay, well, this is a really effective way to cover this guy, to cover politics. So let's start doing the same thing. Was there any consultation with you about setting up that account and everything? Did they ever reach out to you and say, what's your secret? How do you do this? How do you keep up with all this stuff?
No, I have been in touch with some of the people who kind of are associated with the account in terms of, you know, there's a couple of people who are like Biden campaign people on Twitter, but never in like a way to, they've never been in touch to kind of consult with me or anything like that. I do think you're correct that it's sort of inspired by the type of clipping that myself or ASIN does. And in some ways they've kind of, I'm kind of outmoded in the sense that they have a whole team working on that. So, you know, it's just me on my account. But like, I noticed that, you know, they're watching pretty much everything. Trump had some really obscure interview yesterday in like a Pennsylvania TV station. There were a couple clips that were really bad where there was one I saw that I was actually at an NBA playoff game last night. So I was a little bit distracted, but I saw a clip circulating where Trump seemed to not know that Philadelphia is in Pennsylvania, or he was talking about. And so but I believe I saw that on the Biden HQ account. And so they do a really, really good job kind of watching everything and getting clips out there really quick. I mean, yesterday, their approach is very much, which I find to be interesting, that their approach is very much kind of flooding the zone, you know, as you mentioned earlier, in the sense that, you know, I saw yesterday they were just bombarding clips that they're shooting out there of Trump saying all sorts of crazy stuff during COVID. And I don't know if they were doing that because it was the 4-year anniversary of the bleach comment or what was going on. But, you know, it just seems like their strategy is kind of the more clips, the better. And, you know, they've gone from just creating that account a few months ago to like they're well up into 300,000-400,000 followers at this point. And yeah, it's really effective. I mean, it's good to see Democrats kind of take the gloves off and fight like that. So, you know, I think it was smart, and I think that'll be effective for them throughout the campaign.
Yeah, I hope so. And I've been dying to ask you this all day, Aaron. And as a video guy, what's your take on the TikTok ban that the president signed today? How do you peg this? Do you spend a lot of time over there on TikTok?
I don't. And I've actually been thinking more and more that I at least need to create an account to kind of lurk on there. You know, I was just in Italy last week for the International Journalism Festival because I was on a panel.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that came up a lot where, you know, TikTok is really obviously like a vital platform for understanding kind of what youth culture is talking about. And, you know, so many people get most of their news from TikTok that I think just as a journalist, it's probably important for me to at least have some visibility at this point into what's going on there. Mm-hmm. I have seen a lot of people commenting that they think, you know, obviously this isn't going to play well with young voters. And I sort of take people at their word with that. You know, because I'm not directly on there myself. You know, and so I guess I can't really comment. I mean, you know, I've heard a lot of people talk about kind of the concerns surrounding the algorithm. And obviously, this has come up a lot in the context of the Israel-Hamas war and, you know, our people being kind of spun in terms of the TikTok algorithm where, you know, it's kind of rage bait and sort of radicalizing them against Israel. And I just don't know. I don't have enough visibility into what's going on there. I see stuff kind of reposted in other platforms that originates on TikTok, but I'd have to spend more time on the app to kind of have a sense for how the algorithm works and whether it is really kind of like radicalizing people in that way.
So you mentioned the International Journalism Festival, and I think the main point of conversation was Twitter, right? And the future of Twitter and journalists abandoning the platform. Was that the kind of the conclusion of the discussion, is that, yeah, journalists are taking off, they're going to other platforms and not even bothering with Twitter anymore because of the hellscape that it's become since Elon took over? What was the consensus from that panel discussion?
I think it was a little bit more nuanced than that. And this is kind of my own view too, is that it's still vital for, if you're covering the American right or the Republican Party, there's not really, you know, there's so many of them are still posting on there. It's still kind of this, you log on to Threads or Blue Sky and like 10% of the posts you see are Twitter screen caps, you know, because that's where the right wingers are posting. And so to the extent you want to be engaged with what they're saying or know what they're saying, I still feel like it's important in that respect. And I also think that, you know, all the other platforms kind of have their own sets of problems. Blue Sky, I find it just be really limited in terms of features. You can't post video on there. Yeah. Threads has really stifled political content, and it's kind of an echo chamber in that there aren't any conservatives on there. Mm-hmm. You know, and then there's like Mastodon, which is very niche. TikTok's kind of a whole different ball game just in terms of posting and how information spreads on there. So I just feel like there's not really a perfect alternative. So my approach has been just to gain as many toeholds as I can and to diversify where I'm posting. But I don't have any plans to walk away from Twitter. And, my co-panelists, one of them, her name is Mariana Spring. She's the disinformation correspondent for the BBC. And that was kind of her, that's where she came down on it, too, is that for the type of reporting she does on disinformation, obviously, Twitter is kind of disinformation central these days. So you sort of have to pay attention to it in her line of work. And her thing was that, for her, she's kind of like the UK's version of like Taylor Lorenz. The beat is very similar. And she was talking about like 80% of the abuse that the BBC gets via phone calls or emails is directed toward her because of the people that she's covering. And so she has kind of taken more of a posture on Twitter of a lurker, where she's on there, she'll post her work, but she's not really kind of, posting any sort of personal details, or she's really dialed that aspect of her posting back and is mainly just using Twitter to share her work. Yeah. And I've done that a little bit in my own, the way that I approach it as well. But, I certainly think we have to be on guard for Elon. He's already got his thumb on the scale, but kind of putting his whole body on the scale and trying to get Republicans elected this year. But I'm also kind of surprised. I think Twitter is a really good opportunity for Trump. And I'm surprised that he hasn't resumed tweeting, because, just his reach would be so much greater if he stopped being exclusive on True Social, which really nobody is on. And so that to me has been kind of weird. And I wonder if he'll reconsider that, as the campaign heats up.
I'm kind of surprised at Twitter's resilience, to be honest with you. I mean, I've been finding that despite all the horrendous problems over there, many of which you touched upon, it's still kind of a hub for the conversation, isn't it? Like that's the first place people go to maybe get whatever the latest news is, breaking news, and the latest, what I call the first draft of history, which now resides on social media more so than the press. Are you finding the same thing, or does it kind of still feel like the sad mall?
Oh, no, I'm finding the same thing. I mean, it's still pretty much, in terms of using social media, I would say I spend like 90% of my time on Twitter still. And I think you're right. I mean, people like you are on there. I mean, kind of our little group of liberal posters is on there. And then you have, a lot of institutions, news organizations. And, the annoying thing is that on Threads, especially if you're using their algorithmic timeline, like, you'll pull it up if there's a big news event, you'll see posts from like 3 days ago on there.
Yeah.
And so I don't feel like it's quite the same for breaking news as Twitter is, or, was at its peak at least. And, I think that there's kind of obviously a collective action problem here where, if we all sort of banded together, all the big companies and people like me and you and news organizations and said, okay, we're all going to go over to Threads and that's it, we're done with Twitter, maybe that would work. But I think that no one wants to kind of take that step, or very few do. And, people that do, I mean, like Kevin Cruz, the historian from Princeton, who, is one of my favorite Twitter follows, but he stopped posting on Twitter. He's on Threads now, and I'll occasionally pull up Threads and see his posts over there. But it's like I kind of forget about him sometimes because he's not on Twitter, and I'm spending most of my time still on Twitter. And so, I do think it's a very complicated situation, because I do think there is some merit to the arguments about how posting on Twitter legitimizes Elon and kind of this project that he has to turn it into kind of this right-wing misinformation machine and get Republicans elected. And like, I do think there is some validity to that, we'd be better off just kind of like not stoking this guy's ego and helping him and kind of lending our own credibility as liberals to this platform that, we're not really welcome in, or, he's kind of tried to make it uncomfortable for us to spend time there. But I also think you're right that, if I was to quit Twitter, I'd miss seeing your posts on there and seeing posts from, the New York Times and ASIN and all these people who, really do bring a lot of value just in terms of my own processing of the news and consuming information. And I am surprised about the resilience, but I also think that's kind of a reflection of the alternatives being kind of flawed in their own way. And none of them, I just think that an alternative, a suitable alternative has yet to emerge.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons why I'm still over there is not just the community of people who I like to read, for example, your stuff, obviously, and so many others. But the thing is, Twitter isn't throttling political content like the other platforms. Yeah. And you mentioned a second ago about Meta. They're throttling all kinds of political content on Threads, Instagram, both of those places. I've noticed a significant decline in my reach over there. And I thought, you know what? I was feeling good about Threads. I was like, okay, well, look, there's incredible reach over there. What's going on? And then suddenly there was the announcement handed out, oh, we're going to start throttling political content. And that's when it kind of stopped. And over on Blue Sky, I can't seem to get any traction whatsoever over there. That seems like a really slow-moving platform as far as building a following goes. So it's right back to Twitter. It's one of these awful situations where, on one hand, you don't want to support Elon, as you were saying, but on the other hand, God, if you want to get political content, if you want to be part of the conversation, if you want to keep track of whatever's happening as it's happening, Twitter still seems like the only game in town, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, I'm with you. And, you know, I just find myself being constantly annoyed by Threads. Like, for instance, yesterday I posted one of my like 4 years ago today things with the Trump bleach comments. And it ended up one of my videos got hit with a fact check. And it was a super weak fact check where it was from PolitiFact, which is one of their like verified fact checkers that they work with. Uh-huh. But basically was alleging that, you know, oh, Trump didn't really tell people to inject bleach. He was merely speculating that perhaps, you know, light and disinfectants could be helpful, you know. So it was just kind of this like tortured, you know, tag that's on one of my posts over there. But, you know, and that at one point my account was locked over. I quoted something that Ron DeSantis had said about immigration that, you know, was so incendiary that it ended up getting hit with a takedown where I had to delete it. And yeah, it doesn't feel like a very welcome place for political conversation. And so you're right that, you know, Twitter still kind of feels, you know, the most appropriate for talking about politics out of the platforms on offer. And yeah, I was very excited, like you mentioned, with Threads when it came out. And I had really big growth for a few months. Then I think like everybody else, it really kind of just dried up. And so I'm still posting there. It's not like I'm quitting, but if it was supposed to be kind of the platform that would supplant Twitter, I think it's already kind of failed in that respect.
How is Substack as a possible competitor? Because I think they've got sort of a Twitter copycat called, I think it's called Notes. Is that right?
And yes.
It seems like their good decisions are kind of outweighing their bad decisions over on Substack. What's been your experience so far?
Well, so that's interesting because there was a huge scandal. I don't know if scandal is quite the right word, but I don't know if you followed this at all a few months ago, where a number of people bolted from Substack because there was some upset over them not doing more to moderate far right content, and especially with Substack Notes, which was kind of at the core of this whole controversy because Notes functions, like you mentioned, kind of like Twitter, where it's like a posting app. You know, it's part of the Substack app, but you can basically drive people to subscribe to your newsletter and hopefully convert them eventually to paid subscribers. But they do use a little bit of like algorithmic promotion of different newsletters if you pull up your feed. And some people were getting far-right content promoted as part of like the algorithmic feed. And so there was this notion that Substack was promoting kind of far-right views. And so, for instance, one of my co-panelists in Italy, Zoe Schiffer, who is the managing editor for Platformer left Substack and is now on Ghost over this controversy surrounding content moderation. And so, you know, when you mentioned that they're making more good decisions than bad, I think that's kind of debatable. I have been I've been happy as a user of the platform. I mean, I have really good relationships with people there, and the moderation stuff didn't rise to the level for me where I felt like I had to leave. I never really seriously explored that. Now it's kind of died down a little bit. But Notes is never going to be a Twitter. It's never going to kind of take the place of Twitter because it's mainly meant as like a way to promote newsletters and content on Substack. It's not necessarily for kind of like a general audience. But I will say that it's been very helpful for getting subscribers, you know, to driving some traffic to the newsletter. And so they have done a really good job with making it easy for people like me to build audiences. And all of their publishing tools are really easy to use. Which I appreciate. Like, you don't have to have kind of like a, you know, a programming background to figure out how to publish a newsletter on there or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I mean, it has been good. But that, you know, when they announced Substack Notes in the summer of 2013, last year, that was what prompted Elon to have a big outburst where he blocked tweets from being embedded within Substack,
which really kind of
hindered my game a little bit, because I was using that to get video in the newsletter a lot, just like posting my tweets in there. So now I have to kind of use workarounds, post them on YouTube and then embed the YouTube or something like that. So, you know, I guess it's just kind of more, you know, another indication that there really aren't perfect platforms, and that also content moderation is really, really hard. And it's hard to get it right. And I do feel like Substack is making good faith effort, but, you know, it's not enough for everyone, apparently.
Do you get the sense, Aaron, that because of Substack and maybe whatever Substack copycats come along? I mean, I have a big presence on Patreon myself, but is this kind of writing and commentary, is it becoming decentralized again, sort of like Blogosphere 1.0, where it was kind of this Wild West where everyone had their own little blog area? And then after maybe about 2009, somewhere around there, things started to consolidate into social media. And now it feels like everything is expanding again into everyone having their own little niche in the conversation. Is that the direction things are going?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think within the realm of journalism, it's also a consequence of there being so many layoffs in the industry, where I'm seeing more and more reporters who have lost jobs. You know, Laura Bassett being the latest, she was the editor at Jezebel. And then her first post on Substack actually went through the whole kind of tale of woe of, then she got another job, but she was laid off like 2 weeks later. And so finally she's going independent. And, you know, it was kind of a little bit of like a whiff of desperation to it, where it's like, this is kind of it, you know, where it's just impossible to get a job these days in journalism. And so that's not true for everyone. I mean, I think there are people who do Substack just because they want to have an outlet for slightly longer form writing. And if you can make a little bit of scratch, even better. But, you know, for me, it was easy to make a living doing it because I had the economies of scale, just having a huge social media following. And that's not the case for a lot of people. You know, there are a lot of really talented journalists who might only have, you know, 10 or 20,000 followers on Twitter, or they're covering a beat that's kind of general interest. It's not like a super niche beat. And so it can be really hard to kind of convert that type of following into a successful Substack. And, you know, it's also just hard to have the discipline to post a lot. Like, I'm publishing newsletters four times a week, and it's my job. So, you know, I'm really focused on making sure I have good stuff all the time. But, you know, I think you're right. And that's actually the way that you described it. I think I hadn't really thought of it that way, but I think there is a lot to that where, you know, like 20 years ago, everybody kind of had their blog, and that was the way that we consumed the internet. And then it got consolidated with social media. And maybe there is, you know, I don't doubt that part of what we're seeing with the proliferation of Substacks and other platforms like it is, you know, maybe that people feel like they can't rely on these social media platforms like they used to, or there's this fear that they could go away and you want to have a toehold of your own. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that is right. These Substacks can't replace journalism jobs. And that does make me sad that people don't have outlets to write kind of professionally and get compensated for it, having a major institution behind them and being able to kind of specialize into beat expertises and things like that. But, you know, I am glad that it's available and that it's easy to use. And now with Substack Notes, you know, it's really easy to find other people on there too. And so it's a good way. They have tools in-house to kind of help people promote what they're doing and hopefully build audiences.
You know, one of the things I was thinking about too, going back to TikTok real quick, is just the number of people, the vast number of people who have kind of made careers for themselves on platforms like TikTok. I remember back in the day before TikTok, there was a platform called Vine, and it was very similar to TikTok insofar as it was just random short clips, videos, and things like that. Except I think on Vine, it was 7 seconds. They had to be seven seconds or less. But TikTok disappearing, or TikTok getting banned inside the United States, could potentially decimate a lot of careers. And it's something that I worry about a lot, being myself dependent on Patreon for my income. And I always think about, well, God, if Patreon went away tomorrow, I'd be completely fucked. What kind of advice would you give to people who, you know, have built something up, built a following, built a career, built income, but based on one of these platforms, these third-party platforms that we have no financial stake in as far as ownership goes, as far as the future of the company goes, how do you kind of plan for an eventuality like that? Do you have some sort of backup in mind? Like, say, if Substack went away tomorrow, I would do X, Y, and Z. What kind of advice would you give?
Yeah, you know, I haven't been super proactive in that respect. And so I'm probably a little bit, I'm not like probably the greatest example of that. The one thing that I will say for Substack in this respect is that they make it easy to take your email list with you. So, you know, if I got an email, unfortunately Substack is shutting down tomorrow because we're ran out of money or whatever the case, it'd be easy enough for me to download my email list, you know, send all of them an email directly and say, hey, here's the new home for my writing. I'm moving on to this new platform.
That's a great idea.
I really hope it doesn't come to that, and I don't think it will. But and I'm sure Patreon is probably similar in that.
Where
at least you could get directly in touch with people who are your patrons on there and tell them, you know, where to find you next. For instance, I don't know if you were active on Post News, but Post News just sent out a notice the other day that they're shutting down.
Right.
And, Mueller, she wrote, for instance, is probably you follow her on Twitter. But she was posting a ton on Post News. That seemed kind of like her home for a lot of her legal commentary. And they had some interesting tools on Post News where you could paywall posts and have people tip you right within the app. Mm-hmm. And so you can make a little bit of money doing it, you know, doing that. And so that's unfortunate. That's one fewer place that, you know, people can kind of monetize what they're doing. I talk about this sometimes with my spouse. We've been trying to do our taxes, obviously, of late. And it's like, I wish I had more bandwidth to invest into doing taxes and being on top of, you know, kind of limiting my taxable income and stuff like that. But it's like, I'm doing 4 newsletters a week. I mean, that, you know, my mental bandwidth is already pretty maxed out. And then to try and contingency plan for like a future where Substack isn't around, it's just kind of overwhelming to think about. And I'll cross that bridge, I guess, when I get there, but hopefully I don't have to.
Yeah, you know, I found that it's probably a good idea if you're producing that much content to have like a separate repository where you keep an archive of your content, at least your free content, so that at least there's some sort of thing that you control that's separate from one of these third-party platforms that may just vanish overnight. Does Substack have some sort of ability to download all your activity, sort of like Facebook does, or is it just you kind of post it up there and hope that Substack sticks around?
They do have a way to do that. And then also the domain name that I have is a custom domain.
Oh, good.
So I believe that if Substack went away, my site would not, because it's on kind of a separate toehold, but. But I'm not sure about that. That's actually been, my first kind of major job in journalism was as the news blogger for the City Pages in the Twin Cities, which was owned by the Village Voice at the time. And the City Pages ended up going away about 5 years ago, where it was purchased by the Star Tribune, which is the big regional paper here. And then the Star Tribune ended up eventually shutting it down. And, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of words and it was something like 4,000 articles I had written over 4 years for the City Pages. All went up, you know, poof, we're gone overnight at one point. And it was kind of, you know, unfortunate. A few of them, I had a couple features that survive on because they kept like the magazine style features alive on a website. Mm-hmm. But I guess, you know, I've kind of been accustomed to this idea that content online is kind of ephemeral and not necessarily going to be around forever. But, you know, with the newsletter, I've put so much effort into it that you're right. It'd be a shame if that went away. And so that was one of the motivations I had for actually getting a custom URL and kind of my own site, even if I'm using Substack, because hopefully that would allow me to keep everything alive, even if Substack went away.
That's really smart. And, you know, I want to end on a semi-positive note, Aaron. And we've both talked with Simon Rosenberg in recent weeks. Yep. Is he being overly optimistic or on the money, do you think?
I think his analysis is pretty on the money, which is why, you know, I think I've talked with him in the last year like 3 times at different points, once for my podcast, then once right after the 2023 elections, such as they were, just to kind of draw some conclusions from what happened last November and then, you know, recently as well. And, I think that his basic take, I think, you know, has held up well so far and will continue to, which is that Biden has done a good job and Trump is kind of this historic disaster as a candidate for the Republicans. And, you know, when, and we talked about this earlier, where it's like, to the extent that we still believe that stuff matters, Biden should win. And I feel like that's kind of Simon's basic take when you have to boil, you know, if you had to boil it down into one statement, it's like, to the extent that it matters, Biden should win. And, you know, of course, he was really vindicated by the 2022 midterms when, you know, he was out there saying that the red wave was a mirage and mm-hmm. that it was going to be a much closer election than people thought. And then it turned out that he was right about that. So, you know, I think we're already seeing some of the movement that he's been talking about in the polls. You know, the polling averages I've seen lately have it pretty much tied, if not Biden slightly ahead at this point. Mm-hmm. And that's consistent with his basic analysis, which is that, you know, when the statement he made to me was that he really saw things changing recently when it became clear that Trump was having fundraising difficulties and that the Republican Party is broke, basically. Mm-hmm. And that when the mirage of Trump's positive polls went away, it would kind of set in and the media narrative would shift that there's not a whole lot of there with this guy, that it's a lot of bluster. His record isn't good. He doesn't have any money.
Yeah.
And his polling at this point isn't as good as it was a few months ago. And I think, you know, so far his analysis has held up real well. And I guess for all of our sakes, let's hope that continues to be the case.
Yeah. As much as I buy into Simon's take on all of this, I still occasionally will go over and look at RCP and see the polling average and go, what the fuck, man? God, I get like a little bit of a panic attack still. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and the person that I think has done really, he's very humorous about this, but I would recommend people, if you're not already following, and I'm sure most of your listeners are, Josh Marshall over at TPM, because he has been sniffing out, you know, RCP has been kind of stuffing their polling out, their polling averages with like some of these really far right junk polls, and they skew the numbers. And Simon talked about this in an interview too, how he doesn't have a lot of trust in these polling averages because it's very easy to game them. And there's been Republicans have figured out that, you know, if you do a lot of right wing polling, it kind of sogs down these averages in a way that makes Republicans look better than they really are, you know, or their standing looks stronger than it really is. And so I wouldn't put a lot of stock in RCP. I saw just yesterday they announced that they gave some award to Matt Taibbi as Journalist of the Year for 2023. And, you know, it's a pretty weird look for a company that ostensibly does polling, but I think it kind of speaks to what they're up to over there.
Yeah, yeah. So how can people find Public Notice? What is that unique URL you came up with?
It was kind of an expensive one because Public Notice is obviously, if you Google Public Notice, there's a lot of stuff.
Sure.
So it's publicnotice.co.
Okay.
Yep. So it's easy enough to find me there. And I'm at ATRupar on Twitter and Aaron.Rupar on Threads.
Thank you so much, my friend, for today. And all kinds of love to your family, your adorable, adorable children.
Well, that's nice of you to say, Bob. Always a pleasure talking with you. And let's do it again before too long.
Thanks so much, my friend. Great talk.
It's 4 in the morning and I'm not in bed. I can't wonder who's alive or in my head. Oh, mama, dear mama, what a rough ride it's been. I promise to come back. I will not forget. She says it's AT&T. How I make our places call. Said, take sweet time. I'm sure there's no good news at all. You know that I can't wait to see you again. And it breaks my heart every time that I call. They keep you blind, then they'll keep you down. Keep you barefoot and pregnant little babies all around. With the almighty dollar, preachers pray on pray. Yeah, they took away your right to choose. Now what do you gotta say? I say they're dumbing down America, dumbing down TV, they're dumbing down the radio, they're dumbing down to me. It's raining down, it's raining down.
bouncy feet. Coming down, dumbing down.